The Recollections of N. Balaram Reddy, Part 8. Bhagavan or Guru. Once I was in my village pursuing my sadhana when I became very troubled by thoughts relating to the opposite sex. I wrote a letter to Bhagavan through Major Chadwick. Chadwick gave the letter to Bhagavan to read. Bhagavan read it without comment. But at the very time this trouble was brought to Bhagavan's attention by Chadwick, these troubling thoughts left me. Little incidents like this demonstrate the potency of having a guru of Bhagavan's stature. He was always there for us to turn to. If we wanted to question Bhagavan on any matter, we usually had to keep the question with us until we felt that Bhagavan was ready to hear it and reply. Sometimes his look would be so distant, he seemed unapproachable, or he would be so intently occupied, we could not think of disturbing him. Most of us were simply in awe of him and found it difficult to start up some conversation or ask a question. But what questions were we to ask? Did we not have faith in him? And wasn't that what mattered most? And what instructions were we to ask? We all knew his teachings. We all knew what we had to do. Those who had come to him and had taken to his path had already gone through the elementary spiritual practices. Undergraduate or postgraduate students may ask questions of the professor. But those who were working on their PhD degrees or quietly occupied with their research and on rare occasions meet and consult their advisors. The serious aspirants that came to Bhagavan were like PhD candidates. Once I asked Bhagavan why, for no apparent reason, one sometimes feels composed and cheerful, sometimes restless and unusually active, and sometimes lazy and languid. Bhagavan replied, "In man, the three gunas of nature, prakriti, are in constant movement. When sattva comes to the fore, one is quiet and cheerful. When rajas predominates, one is restless. When tamas is uppermost, one is languid and cheerless." "How to get over their influence?" I asked. "By becoming a gunadita, transcending the gunas," he replied. "How to become a gunatita?" "By realizing the self," Bhagavan concluded. The Maharishi was available to all. The management may have put limits on length of stays in the ashram, but anyone could live outside the ashram and daily come and visit the Maharishi. The women devotees did that. Since no women were allowed in the ashram at night, they all had to leave after the evening meals. One day, about 7 p.m., when it had already turned dark, an indiscreet incident between a man and woman occurred. When Bhagavan came to know of it, he said that the women devotees should be fed their evening meal by 6:30 p.m. and then sent home. In the case of moral propriety, Bhagavan intervened, but he would never judge or condemn people for their moral lapses. He understood human frailty and was determined to teach us how to transcend it, not to dwell on it. In Bhagavan's hall, the devotees would be occupied with one of three things. Some would be sitting in silent meditation with eyes closed. Some would be quietly gazing on Bhagavan's holy form. Others would be engaged in discussion, which usually consisted of questions put to Bhagavan. Any other activities required permission from the office. Once, T.M.P. Mahadevan had just returned from a trip to the West. He delivered lectures wherever he went, and a number of those lectures were about Bhagavan and his teachings. A few of the resident devotees wanted to hear an example of how he lectured on Bhagavan. He offered to give one right then and there. But before he could do this, permission had to be taken from the office. Without undue delay, it was given. T.M.P. Mahadevan then gave a lecture. Except for this lecture, I don't ever remember anyone giving a lecture in the hall. Although there were those whose very questions were the equivalent of a lecture. Usually, such visitors wanted to show off their knowledge. Also, I don't remember many songs or bhajans being sung in the hall, except for the daily parayanas. Devotees did occasionally sing, no doubt, but permission was also required. Personally, I preferred to sit quietly before Bhagavan. In this way, I felt I was reaping greater benefit than any puja or sankirtan. There was one Daivaratha, a devotee of Bhagavan, who had been living in the north for some years and who had just returned to the ashram for a visit after a long absence. Among other things, he was known for his enthusiastic kirtan and dancing. He used to do it in earlier years before the Maharishi and while doing pradakshina of Arunachala. Some of the devotees expressed a desire to see him perform. It was arranged in the dining hall. Bhagavan sat where he usually did at mealtime, and we all sat in rows. Daivaratha began singing and dancing up and down the rows with great enthusiasm. He also sang Ganapati Muni's Chatvarimsat in his own melody, dancing with the tune. Once the private secretary to the governor of Pondicherry arrived at the ashram with a few of his associates, he came into the hall with a large sheet of paper filled with a long list of questions written in an elaborate, complex style of French. He handed the paper over to Bhagavan, walked over to the window opposite Bhagavan's couch, and sat on the window sill. Bhagavan looked at the questions and, noticing they were written in French, called me to him and asked me to translate them. I found the French difficult to translate, and I was struggling with it word by word while translating it to Bhagavan. Bhagavan, realizing my difficulty, said, "That is not necessary. Just to tell me what the gist of this question paper is." I scanned through the whole list of questions and then told Bhagavan that it says that he really doesn't want oral answers to all of these questions, but rather the answer in the form of an experience. Bhagavan paused for a moment. He then slowly turned his face in the direction of the questioner and rested his eyes on him. When about 30 seconds passed like this, I noticed the man's body began to tremble. Soon he was shaking all over. Then he blurted out, "Oh no, Bhagavan, not now. Please, Bhagavan, not now." I was standing a little to the side of Bhagavan, watching this extraordinary scene and wondering what a being this Bhagavan is. He is a storehouse of power, but yet so kind, gentle and compassionate. And in spite of all this grandeur, he always seems so human and natural, even laughing and joking with us on occasions. The attendants used to spread various sheets over Bhagavan's couch, changing them frequently. Occasionally, they would place a tiger skin on the couch, and Bhagavan would sit on that too, just like it was any other sheet. Once I was sitting near the end of Bhagavan's couch facing him. That day, a tiger skin had been spread on the sofa and the head of the tiger was hanging over the armrest and seemingly staring straight at me. Chadwick was also sitting in the hall at the west end. He would usually follow a punctual schedule, and at exactly 7 p.m., he rose to leave. On his way out, he walked up behind me and whispered in my ear, "Do you see? That is Chinnaswamy, the ashram tiger, staring straight at you." We both chuckled at the joke. When Chadwick went out, Bhagavan asked me what Chadwick had said to me. When I repeated it, Bhagavan enjoyed the humor and we both laughed. Gandhians and service. Now and then, before India gained independence, followers of Mahatma Gandhi's Swaraj movement would visit the ashram. Most of these visitors were not what we would call spiritual aspirants, but rather social reformers. They would question Bhagavan about their work and ambitions. Sometimes Bhagavan would answer, and other times he would simply remain quiet. On one occasion, a prominent leader for the advancement of the lower classes came on a visit. She asked Bhagavan a number of questions concerning her work and ideals. Bhagavan simply listened and remained silent. The lady left. Shortly after her visit, an article written by this lady was found in a Madras newspaper. She wrote that she had discussed all her plans with Bhagavan and he agreed with them. When Bhagavan saw this, he commented, "What can I do? Even if I am silent, such statements are printed in the newspapers." Rajendra Prasad was an intimate disciple of Mahatma Gandhi, but unlike many others in the freedom struggle, he had genuine spiritual leanings. I was in the ashram in August of 1938 when he visited, together with Jamnalal Bajaj and others. I don't think we can say that Gandhi sent him to visit the Maharishi. Probably, Rajendra Prasad had a desire to meet Bhagavan and benefit from his company, and Gandhi, being broad-minded, gave him permission to go. Those who actually followed Gandhi's ideals could be called Karma Yogis. Adi Shankaracharya writes that Karma Yoga is useful for purifying the mind, but the purified mind has to be harnessed to some technique of spiritual practice. Only then will the sadhana be effective. Bhagavan has said that only a true jnani can be a true karma yogi. It is not that doing good works and giving to others is wrong, but only a jnani knows that there are no others. That is only the self. Who is to give to whom? Bhagavan's whole life was simply an offering to the world. Everything he did was for others only. The scriptures say that a jnani has no will of his own, and whatever he does is prompted by Ishvara or God. Bhagavan knew that social service could temporarily relieve suffering to some extent. He also knew that the same person who was helped would someday come to grief again, not only later in this life, but in life after life. To remove all suffering, to completely extinguish the cause of all suffering, the Maharishi was born. He wanted to liberate us from the mistaken belief that we are this frail body, mind, and ego. To do this, he gave the method of self-inquiry, showed us how to practice it, and effectually aided seekers by his powerful presence and grace. But even with all that he taught us, there were many who came to him, stayed for some time, and then went astray. Such was the case with the pious attendant of Bhagavan, Madhava. He worked in the ashram for about 10 years, mostly serving Bhagavan as a personal attendant. At one point, he seemed to have become restless, or perhaps he felt that he required rest somewhere away from the ashram. At this juncture, he came to me one day and asked if I could help him with the travel fare to Yogi Ramaya's ashram in Andhra Pradesh. Up to this point, Madhava was considered a model devotee. Everyone praised his virtues of steadiness, devotion, and service to Bhagavan. So I was a little surprised when he told me he desired to leave the ashram. I asked him what Bhagavan and Chinnaswamy said about his plans. He told me that they both approved of them. Later, I discovered it was not so. Bhagavan had recommended that he simply cease working for some time, take his meals in the ashram, and rest free from all responsibilities. Apparently, he did not heed Bhagavan's advice and as a result had to suffer. Madhava left the ashram as planned but returned after a short time. His job as one of Bhagavan's attendants had already been given to someone else. Consequently, he had nothing to do when he returned, and I would often see him sitting in Bhagavan's hall. His restlessness persisted, and it wasn't long before he left the ashram again. When he returned a second time, he was wearing ochre robes, which means he must have been initiated into sannyasas by some swami during his travels. Yet he was still unsettled, and he went away again. Then, all of a sudden, we heard he had died in Kumbakonam under strange circumstances. It is not altogether uncommon for aspirants to deviate from the prescribed path after coming to Bhagavan. It is only those who persist to the end with their spiritual practice, devotion, and faith that succeed. Of course, Bhagavan's helping hand is always there for those sincere sadhakas who strive and reach out for it. Once the Sarvadhikari asked me to set my alarm so I could wake up at 2 a.m. It was discovered that Bhagavan was rising at this time every night and walking to the latrine near the Goshala. The attendants were sleeping right through this, and of course, Bhagavan probably took special care not to disturb their sleep when he rose. When the Sarvadhikari discovered what was happening, he became concerned that if Bhagavan should fall or some other mishap should occur, there would be no one to help him. So at 2 a.m. I awoke and walked over and stood near Bhagwan, who was then reclining on the couch outside on the veranda. When Bhagwan saw me standing there, he quietly slipped off the couch and walked to the latrine with the aid of a flashlight. I followed. No words passed between us. There is no doubt that Bhagwan understood why I was there and who requested me to come at this hour of night, yet everything transpired in silence. On such occasions, when silence prevailed, we would assume that Bhagwan approved or was pleased. When he was displeased, we could easily know, for he did not hesitate to correct us. In this way, we were always on our guard and alert to his will. One day, I received a letter from a family informing me that they were traveling to Tirupati. They requested me to leave the ashram and meet them there. When Bhagwan was returning from his walk and was near the well, I mentioned the details of this letter to him. He made no reply. Now, how could I just leave? Normally, he would indicate his approval of the plan by asking questions or commenting, and in some manner make it clear to me that it was all right to go ahead. In this instance, he said nothing and just kept walking. The very next day, I received another letter from a family informing me that the trip was cancelled. How can we explain this? Is it a siddhi, a miracle, or what? Everything happened naturally in Bhagwan's presence, and he was always so unassuming. To be continued.